I remember so clearly my first day of college. I had the opportunity to attend Stanford, which is how I ended up here at PBC about 25 years ago. And I can still picture pulling up to my freshman dorm for the first time. I arrived and I was walking up and there was a table set out by the entrance with some upperclassmen there. And they recognized me from the pictures I'd sent in prior to arriving. And over the loudspeakers, it bellowed, "Welcome, Paul Taylor!" And they started cheering, and there was clapping, and it was this, like, incredibly welcoming, warm experience. And I just thought, all I did was show up. And I'm included. You know, I'm part of this thing. They're happy I'm here. I'm part of this new community. Now, during orientation week, they gathered us together, and they taught us what it was like to be students, and they made special care to teach us one of the most important things that we had to know. We were all gathered into one auditorium, and some upperclassmen came on stage, and they said some simple words and taught us how to respond to them. They said, "UC Berkeley." And then they hissed. And they taught us to do that. They said, "Now that you're part of this community, that must be your response to those words." And they would test us throughout the week. And so by the end, it was very clear. UC Berkeley equals hissing. That's right. See, it's easy to learn, right? You kind of get caught up in it. Now, all those people had done was show up at a different place. But they were not like us. We were this kind of people. They were that kind of people. We were welcomed in loudspeakers and joy, and they were hissing. Isn't this how we work as people? We are by nature tribal. We band together in groups, and if you're part of one group, then you're welcome. You're part of something. You're all on the inside. But if you're outside the group, you're outside. You're excluded. You're mocked or scorned even. What I experienced as a freshman at Stanford happens in hundreds of ways all over the world, with political groups, with ethnic groups, with social groups, with high school groups, with professional groups. We are taught, carefully instructed, sometimes explicitly, who to love and who not to love. Sometimes we just pick it up by noticing the reactions of the people around us. And it is into this basic human tendency that Jesus' most radical instruction lands like a bomb and explodes everything up. So as I said, we're in the middle of this series. We're calling it Blessed Are on the Sermon on the Mount, because Jesus is speaking in this message to a group of Jewish peasants on a hillside above the Sea of Galilee, and he's giving them a picture of what it looks like to live the good life, the blessed life, what it looks like to live in what he calls the kingdom of the heavens. And for the last 6 weeks, we've been looking at six similar statements that Jesus makes, where he begins by quoting an Old Testament law, a law that people would be familiar with, and then he challenges that law by making it something different. And it sounds at first like he's making it harder to follow, but what we've observed is what he's really doing is he's trying to get at our hearts. He's trying to help us to see what it looks like when we live immersed in the kingdom of the heavens. We've seen him work through anger, lust, sex, revenge, and truth. And now he arrives at the core issue that lies behind all of these. This morning we're going to see him talk about love. And as we hear these words, we're going to realize that Jesus isn't just getting at our hearts. He's not just trying to transform us. He's showing us something about who God the Father is. This morning, we're going to get a peek into the heart of God. Now, when you first read these words, though, they make no sense. We can't even imagine how to live following these words. It seems impossible. Almost no other ethical framework or religious framework in the world has a way of approaching other people like this. Bertrand Russell is a famous atheist, and he had this to say: "The Christian principle, love your enemies, is good. There's nothing to be said against it, except that it's too difficult for most of us to practice sincerely. It's just impossible. But as we look at these words, we're going to discover something significant. Not only are they possible, but this way of life, this way of being, lies at the heart of what it looks like to be in God's kingdom. It's a whole different mindset, but it opens up to us a different kind of life. We're going to find, I think, that we want to live this way, but it just seems so far off. How can Jesus say this? Love your enemies. How do you love someone who's hurt you? How do you love someone who hates you? How do you love someone you don't get along with? How do you love someone that's your enemy? We're going to look in depth at what Jesus says. We'll start by really figuring out this old law that he references and kind of try to get our minds around that, and we'll understand why that comes so naturally to us, this tribal mentality. And then we're going to look at how Jesus reframes that and what it means to love your enemy. And then we'll see how Jesus concludes this command and how he invites us into this whole new approach of looking at life. We'll start off with this first phrase that Jesus suggests. He starts by quoting one of the most well-known laws in the Christian world: love your neighbor. He begins, "You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy." Now, Christians love this first phrase, love your neighbor. This is one of our biggest commands. We taught a whole preaching series on this. Love God, love your neighbor. This is how we think what it means to be a Christian. You find this all throughout the Old Testament. But Jesus does something funny with this phrase. He adds something to it. Love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Now, nowhere in the Old Testament does it actually say you ought to hate your enemy. Jesus isn't quoting anything there. But if you think about the command, love your neighbor, it's kind of like half of a law, right? Because I'm supposed to do this to this group of people, my neighbor. But that begs the question, people who aren't my neighbor, what do I do with them? And the natural conclusion is, well, you don't love them. You love your neighbor, so you hate your enemy. It kind of makes sense. And so while this isn't a law that was explicitly said in the Old Testament, this is kind of how people learned to operate. It made sense that there was people who were outside the category of neighbor whom I was not supposed to love. And this is what I was taught during freshman orientation at college. Your neighbors are your fellow students, and those outside that group you must respond to by hissing. The other group are your enemies. We should view them with scorn and condescension. We want to see them destroyed. All in the name of a friendly rivalry, right? This is the kind of mentality we have. Everyone, everywhere, in every part of the world operates like this. We form these little groups, and we understand that when you're within the group, you're part of me. Now let's think about how this works. I've got a little diagram, but there's a lot of engineers here, so we're going to think about this visually, all right? We tend to think about our identity in terms of the groups that we're a part of. So let me show you this. So I traveled to Kenya several years ago, and when I got to Kenya, I met another American in Kenya. And it was wonderful. And it was like we were long-lost brothers, right? I mean, here's another person from my country far away because I'm an American. That's one circle that I identify with, right? But around here, I meet another American, and I think, oh, no big deal, right? You're all Americans. A lot of us are Americans. Some aren't, but that's fine. I go to Texas, right? I have family in Texas, and when I'm in Texas, I meet another Californian. And I think, this is great. We're long-lost brothers, you know. Here we are, Californians in Texas, because that's another part of my identity. I'm a Californian. But when I'm here, I meet a lot of Californians, and, you know, it's no big deal. But then in California, I go to the grocery store, and I meet a Christian. And I think, well, that's great, you know. We're both Christians, and there's not many Christians in California, so there's this instant connection. But then I come to church, and I meet other Christians, and it's no big deal. Or I'm at a conference, and then I'm at a conference and I meet a non-denominational Christian. And all of a sudden, it's like, this is great, we're just like each other. You know, that's another part of my identity. And that's not, we're both non-denominational. We're not Presbyterian or Baptist or, you know, we are not something. It's such a funny identity, right? We are not denominational. That's how we identify.
But then I come to PBC and, you know, we're all non-denominational, so it's no big deal. But then I meet somebody who reads the ESV, you know, and I think, oh, this is great, right? I mean, other people at PBC read the NIV, but we read the ESV, and, you know, instantly there's this connection, right? And it's just the circles get smaller and smaller because there's all of these ways that I identify myself, and there's kind of, depending on where I am, I identify with other people depending on whether they're similar to me or not. You're in my tribe if you're like me, and if you're different from me, then you're outside of my tribe. That's kind of the basic way we operate. And the whole system works. My relationship works when you're like me. Because I might operate differently in different contexts, but the one thing that's the constant is me. The system is built around my identity. I'm at the center. And it works if you are like me. Everyone operates this way. This is what we do. All of us walk around, I think, with this kind of concentric circle mentality, and we're always figuring out where people fit in our little universe of identities. Even the people who are outside of your tribe, they're outside your circles, they have their own circles. And this is what Jesus points out when he says this. He picks two categories of people. He says, "For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same?" See, Jesus picks two categories of people that for these Jewish peasants on the hillside above the Sea of Galilee, they were definitely far outside of their circles. In fact, when the Jewish peasants would have heard Gentiles, they would have immediately thought of the Romans who flaunted their food laws, who stole their money, who lived in their land, who abused them and oppressed them. The Romans were the Gentiles, and they had their own circles. But even worse than the Romans, in a way, were the tax collectors. Because the tax collectors were Jews. They were within the circle, but they sided with the Romans. They worked for them. They saw the occupation as a chance to make a quick buck. And so they were traitors, betraying their own people for the sake of prosperity. But even those people who were the worst, they were way outside my circle, but they had their own circles. They treated each other nicely, and they had their own world. So here's this question for ourselves. What are your circles? Who are you? We may not resonate much, I think, in our culture with having enemies. You probably don't wake up in the morning and check a list of enemies. But you have tribes, and there are people who fall outside of those tribes. Who's on the outside for you? Who is it that is outside of your tribe? That's the person Jesus is talking about when he says, love your enemy. In the first century, the answer would have been very clear. The enemy was the Romans. The enemy were the oppressors of the Romans, the traitors of the tax collectors. But we have our own circles. We have our own people who stand against us. And really, anybody who stands against me, because I'm the definition in this world, anybody who's outside of what I think is okay, that's the enemy. And that's somehow the person that Jesus said, I'm supposed to love. Keep those people in mind. Keep kind of a category of person in mind in your head as we keep going in this text. Because I want us to think about how it works that we could grow to love that kind of person. What Jesus does then is he challenges this basic approach to life. He's rewriting the rules of how we're supposed to relate to people in these different categories. Is what he says in verses 44 to 45. "But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven." And then he points out what God is like. He says, "For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and he sends rain on the just and on the unjust." Now remember that the Jews thought of themselves as God's chosen people.
God had chosen them. God had blessed them. God had given his law to them. God had made them special. And remember how critical their identity was wrapped up in that part of themselves, of being Jewish and having the law, being God's chosen people. But now Jesus points out that God is actually incredibly generous with his love. And so Jesus roots this command to love your enemy in the person of God, in who God is, and how God treats his creation. And that's actually a really helpful way for us to think about it, because it helps us to understand what Jesus means when he says, love your enemy. He doesn't mean let them oppress you. He doesn't mean let them abuse you. He doesn't mean just lay down and take anything. He's talking about this kind of general approach towards being generous with your blessing. The first topic Jesus dealt with in these six sections was anger. And when we looked at that passage, we saw how Jesus began with anger, but he brought it down to the issue of contempt, the issue of how we tend to take other people and view them as less than us, as how we eventually make them out to be less than human. And that's one way that we categorize other people. And if you've been tracking, we can kind of see how that basic core issue of contempt, of seeing people as other than you, that's formed a background for all of these issues of lust and sex and revenge and manipulation. And so now here we see that what God does, his basic approach to people is that he doesn't do that. He sees everybody as human. There's no contempt in the heart of God. And so this love for enemies is really about seeing others and respecting others and treating them as human, as wanting what's best for them. It's really about loving those people who are different from us, outside of our circles, loving people who are outside your tribe. That's the invitation here. But it doesn't make sense. It's not the way we're taught to operate. It's not the way that we tend to be in this world. And yet, this ethic would be the defining ethic of Jesus' early followers. This is what made them distinct in the world around them. Everybody loved the people within their tribes, but the Christians, the ones who follow Jesus, they did the impossible. They loved those people outside. They rescued babies that they had no obligation to. They sacrificed themselves for people in the communities that weren't Jewish, that weren't a part of their group. Even when they were being oppressed, even when they were being martyred by the Romans, they loved. As Jesus did when he died, he prayed, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Jesus' followers somehow managed to have that same kind of attitude, loving and praying for their enemies. I think it's helpful the way Jesus phrases this because it acknowledges that we will have enemies. There will be people who are outside of our tribes, people who stand in our way, people who annoy us, people who challenge us, people we find it very difficult to get along with. But our attitude towards them is defined by who God is. It doesn't have to be defined by our identity. I've mentioned before that my wife and I have gone through several difficult seasons in our marriage that we found intimacy to be something we've had to work hard at. And it's an incredible prize. God has been good to us, but it's been taking different seasons of working at it. And in one of those seasons, we were in marriage counseling, and the counselor was kind of trying to get at my heart. And he was asking me what I was feeling, and he was kind of guiding me along. And finally, he said, "Well, how do you feel like Rachel is to you?" And I said, "Well, sometimes it feels like she's my enemy." And that's the kind of phrase that Christian counselors just love, you know. It's like pitching him a softball, right? Because he just says, well, you know, what does Jesus say about how we treat our enemies? Oh, come on, you know. But the helpful thing about that is that it gave me the freedom to articulate where I felt, to articulate my sense, you know, that in this particular encounter, I don't remember the issue, whatever it was, but that, you know, it felt like we were on opposite sides, and it wasn't like demeaning that, or you shouldn't feel that way. Maybe in that moment it does feel like you're enemies, but that doesn't change how you treat the person. So the question then becomes, how do I love my enemy? How do I do this? How do I live by this incredible ethic? And as we try that, we realize that it's impossible. This is really hard stuff. And as we've been seeing these commands in the Sermon on the Mount, we've realized that Jesus isn't giving us a new law to follow. He's not saying, this is now the standard. He's been trying to help us see our hearts, and he's been giving us these snapshots of pictures of what it looks like when you're really living in the kingdom of the heavens. And so the question is, how do we become the kind of people who live this way? What has to happen in our hearts for this to be our reality? And we realize that for that to happen, the whole system has to change. The whole approach that we take to the world has to be different. And that's what Jesus concludes with. Again, Jesus' statement at first sounds impossible. It sounds like an absolutely unreachable goal. He wraps up this section in verse 48 by saying, "You therefore must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect." And this is not just a summary of the command to love your enemies. I think this is a summary statement of this whole section of six topics that Jesus has been dealing with. And he wraps it up once again in who God is. But when we read this, we think, there's no way. There's no way I can be perfect. But remember how Jesus began. He started this section by saying, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. And if we just take it on face value, it sounds like Jesus might be saying, here's this spectrum, and here's the scribes and the Pharisees, and here's God. And at first he says, you have to be better than the scribes and the Pharisees. And now he's saying, you got to ace this test. You got to get 100 or nothing. But remember that we've been saying all along, that's not the model Jesus is going on. He's not saying you need to play the same game that the scribes and the Pharisees are playing. You just have to be better than them. He's saying the whole system is different. And so what he's getting at here is, your goal is not to be like the Pharisees. Your goal is to be like God. And that's actually really encouraging to me because I know some people that I think are Pharisees. I know some Christians who I would describe as similar to the Pharisees. And I don't really want to be like those people. I don't want to be like them, but just a little bit better at the game. I want to be different. I want to be like Jesus. That's the model that is compelling to me. The word Jesus uses here for perfect is the word teleai. It's a word that means complete or fulfilled. Sometimes it's translated mature. Sometimes it's translated fulfilled. It's the same word Jesus used from the cross. It's a similar root when he said tetelestai. It is finished. It has been completed. And so this word has the sense of not 100% on a test, but of arriving at a destination, of fulfilling the purpose for which something was created. And so when Jesus says you must be perfect, he's saying you must fulfill the purpose for which you were created. You must arrive at the way of being you that God always intended for you to be you. And at the heart of that is who God is. You must be like God. And what Jesus is doing is giving us an entirely new system to live in. This is the transformation that happens when you live in the kingdom of the heavens. You become a different kind of person. Now remember the diagram about how we view the world, right? Me at the center, all of these various kind of categories that I find myself in. But what Jesus is suggesting here is a different model. The model Jesus is suggesting has God at the center. He is a model for life. Now think about the fact that God himself is a Trinity. So God is at the center of this model, and God himself is what theologians describe as three persons with one essence. Now, what happens when you have three people in a room? If there's one person in a room, if I'm alone, it's fine. It's just me, right? I'm happy because I'm me. If you come in the room, one more person, we're fine. We can have a relationship. You know, there's two of us. We can talk, run the same team. As soon as there's three people in a room, there are tribes, right?
It always tends to happen. You know, there's two on one. Somebody's always a third wheel. There's always some dynamic that operates that way. But God is a Trinity. And yet, within God, there are no tribes. It's not like the Father and the Son team up on the Spirit every now and then and prank him, or, you know, the Spirit and the Father are making fun of Jesus. That's just not the way it works. The Trinity is this perfect model of community, of love, of respect, of cooperation. And so that forms the heart of this new way of thinking. And then around that is the kingdom of the heavens. This is the kingdom, the kingdom that's gathered around God as a Trinity at the center. And within that kingdom are all sorts of different people. Some are different, some are similar, some are Jews, some are Pharisees, some are tax collectors, some are Romans, some are peasants, some are rich, some all different kinds of people. And then there's you. You're one of those people in that kingdom of the heavens, gathered around God as the Trinity. You're not at the center. Nothing revolves around you. You're there as part of God's world. And so the path that you're on is becoming like God. See, the other system worked when other people were like us because we were at the center. That system worked when you were like me. But this system has God at its center. And so this system works when we're like God, when we have his approach to the world and his attitude towards others. This is the path that we're on. If you're a follower of Jesus, this is what we're doing. We're growing towards being like God. As we follow Jesus here in Silicon Valley, our whole goal is to be like God. Now, we have such a hard time imagining what this could be like. You can see, when we think this way, I think this is what we hear. We hear, how can I, me, with all of my shortcomings and failures, how can I act like God? How can I perform on the test as well as God performs on the test? How can I get a score that's high enough, just like God? That's the way we tend to think, but that's impossible. I can never be like God. I'm imperfect. I'm not yet fulfilled. I'm not yet complete. I haven't yet arrived at who God created me to be. So how can I possibly be like God? An apple tree can't grow peaches. It doesn't work. But if God changes me, if God transforms my heart, if Jesus starts to live within me and the Spirit guides me day by day, and slowly over time I grow so that I am transformed from within, then I find myself being like God because that's who I am. I find myself acting like God, not because I'm performing, trying to measure up, but that's just what I do. I become a peach tree and I grow peaches because that's what happens. When we become like God, we live in the kingdom of the heavens. We find ourselves in his world. We find ourselves immersed in the way of life that he has designed. And we love our enemies simply because that's what God does. There are no tribes within the Trinity, and there are no tribes within the kingdom of the heavens. There is only God's love for the world, emanating out from him, filling the world. There's only the invitation to participate in that love, to receive it, to be a part of what God has created. That's all there is. And so we are just, as Jesus said, sons of our Father who is in heaven. We're just part of his system. And our enemies are just other people in God's system. And so it becomes natural to love them. Think about that kind of life. What would it feel like? What would your experience, what would it feel like to wake up in the morning and to be like God? Think about your heart emptied of anger and lust and revenge and the desire to manipulate others. Wouldn't that be incredible? Don't you want to live that way? Isn't that just the kind of life you've always wanted, not who you are acting not angry, acting like you don't want revenge, but think about if you woke up in the morning and you just didn't want those things. If somebody hurt you and your tendency, your natural tendency was to love them, not to let them abuse you, not to lay down. We're not talking about that. That's not how Jesus loved people, but to seek what is best for them. That's what love is. What if your heart were transformed so this is just who you were? That's an incredible picture. I find that so compelling. That's what I want. I want to live that way. And this is the path that we're on if we're walking in the kingdom of the heavens. This is how we're growing. None of us are there. We're still angry. We still want to take revenge. We're still full of lust. We still try and manipulate people around us. We find ourselves trapped in between. But as we follow Jesus, as we immerse ourselves in the love of God, we start to change. Day by day, slowly, and we find ourselves transformed into God's likeness. Think about all the tribes in our world. Stanford and Cal, Republican and Democrat, blue collar, white collar, upper class, lower class, NIV readers and ESV readers. All the different ways that we categorize people. We put people in boxes. Think about that. Think about billions of people around the world walking around in these concentric circles with me at the center, and how they bump up against other concentric circles, and all of the tension and violence and hatred and problems that that creates. There's so much pain in the world. There's so much hurt. But think about a different way. Think about this different vision that Jesus gives of the kingdom of the heavens with the Trinity at the center and all of us included in God's life because of his love for us. This is the kind of picture that Jesus is trying to paint in the Sermon on the Mount. I hope that you've caught at least a glimmer of how stunningly beautiful that kind of life could be. The poor in spirit are blessed. Those hungry for justice are satisfied. We live like God without anger or lust or revenge or hatred. We experience that. Now I know a lot of you here today are walking that life. You're trying to do this. You're asking what it means to follow Jesus. You're trying hard, and sometimes it feels like you're making progress, and other times it feels like nothing's happening or you're walking backward. I think my encouragement for you is to just keep at it, to persevere. This is not an overnight thing. This is not something you just flip a switch. This is a long journey walking with Jesus, allowing him to teach us and show us. Others of you here today may not feel like you know what I'm talking about. You may come to church, you may think this is great, but this kind of journey, this kind of transformation, it feels like a fairy tale. It feels like a myth. Like, how could that possibly be true? I have no idea what that kind of life could look like. And if that's you, I'd encourage you to ask God, what's the next step? What's the next step for you to take on this journey to living this kind of life? This is what Jesus holds out for us. It's incredibly beautiful, but it's a long road. What's the next thing you can do? There's all sorts of ways around the church you can get involved. If you're a man, you can come to Road Crew on Wednesday mornings. If you're a woman, there's a Thursday morning group. There's a Tuesday night group. If you're a youth, there's a youth group. If you're in recovery, there's a recovery group. If you're newly married, there's a newly married group. If you're an NIV reader, we have an NIV group. We actually don't. We don't like those people. Just kidding. Jump in somewhere. I mean, you know, and these, it's not that programs make you like God, but all that we're doing around here as a church, everything we do, we're just trying to gather people in groups to journey on this road together, to just walk with other people, to learn from each other, to challenge each other, to encourage each other. That's all that we do. So find a group, find some place to connect where you can be encouraged along that journey. I want to invite the band up, and they're going to lead us in some response songs, thinking about God's love, thinking about how we can live in this kind of kingdom. And I want to pray for us. I want to pray that our systems would be transformed, that we could see God's love at the center of our lives, and that we could be drawn into this kingdom, this new way of living where we are simply part of what God is doing. And as we live there, we see ourselves slowly transformed more and more into his likeness. Let me pray for us. Father, it's so tempting for us to just see the world in comparison to people that are like us and people that are different from us. But at the end of the day, that is a enslaving way to live. We feel trapped by our own identities, and we don't know how to relate to others. So God, I pray that you would give us the freedom, that you would be working in our hearts. Give us the courage to take the next step, that we might live as part of the kingdom of the heavens and see our lives transformed into more and more your likeness, so that we become like you. We experience your life, and we love those around us. We ask this in the name of Jesus. Amen.